Kevin.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm going to look, I'm an alcoholic. Morning. Oh, we join the serenity prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I have a sobriety date, March 31st, 1972. I have a home group, Thursday Men's. I have a sponsor, Lad's his name. I've lost three of them. He's the fourth one. He's nervous. I found it by attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that if I start my day every day with asking for God's guidance to help me through the day, applying the program, which is the 12 steps to my life, applying the four absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity, and continuing to attend AA meetings and come into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous so that I can watch the good examples and judge myself as to where I am and if I'm slipping back or staying up there. I've learned that over the years, you know, if you got a year, if you got a month, or if you whatever you have out there, and I got 36 years, about the only difference between us right at this point in life is that the ice on my pond's a lot thicker than yours, but you know, ice is slipping no matter how thick it is, so we better do the same thing every day, no matter how long you're in, you're going to do the right thing. I don't wish people in AA a Merry Christmas or a Happy New Year. New Year's coming, and the reason I don't wish it is because I can guarantee it if you do what I just got done saying. You know, it doesn't mean that you won't have a sorrowful year. It doesn't mean that things won't happen in your life. Right now, I'm dealing with my wife being in a nursing home, hopefully being able to get out. She's been hospitalized since November 6th, and probably the longest I've made many times she's been in there. And, you know, like I've always said, I've learned what the serenity prayer is for. It's to accept things you don't like. You know, you never have to say a prayer for something you like. I mean, I don't. If you win the lottery, you know, next week, I'm sure you're not going to say the serenity prayer before you cash your ticket. Make sure you can accept it. So you don't have to worry about things you like. You're going to just worry about them things that you don't like. There's nothing. Acceptance doesn't mean you have to like it. Acceptance means you just understand and accept it. And it took me a while to learn that, but I understand that today. I started drinking when I was around 15 years old. I don't get into my childhood. I don't get into gum loving. I don't get into none of that junk. The only thing I'll tell you about my childhood that was important is it was long, like 40 years. Other than that, there's nothing really important about it. I was born and raised down on the south side of Cleveland. That's that place they call Tremont now. They changed the name of it so they could sell them $20,000 homes for $200,000. But it's still the south side. And I started my drinking in Lincoln Park. And back then, Lincoln Park was not like it is now. Now it's a flat piece of grassland with a swimming pool and that. Back then, it had hedges around it. And I'm not exaggerating when I say they were 12 foot high and 12 foot wide. And it was like a little town in there. You didn't go in there after dark unless you were part of a, I would say a group, be nice about it, probably was a gang. And, but I was, you know, got nosy as to what was going on there when I was around 15. And so I hooked up with some guys and went into the park and they handed me a bottle of beer and terrible stuff. I couldn't understand. I didn't drink this junk. I did not like beer. But to belong, I did what I had to do. But I learned something quick about beer. You know, if you shoot it down real quick three or four times, you know, you burp a lot. If you burp a lot and you spill a little out in front of you and you carry the bottle around with you, you stink. And that's as bad as you'll stink. I don't care how much you drink. So, you know, I would just take my time and I just watch people. And I could act like, you know, I could act like somebody that was had six beers or eight beers or 12 beers. It didn't really matter. I just watched them and acted like them. And one of the things that when I finally started attending these meetings I always used to wonder if the greatest day in my life was when I went into the Rosary Hall, but sometimes I think the greatest day in my life was the day that I was sitting in a meeting and realized I belonged here. Because for the longest time, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And once I realized I belonged here, then I started realizing why we had a program. Because I could act dumb without being drunk, and I could act stupid without being drunk, and I could act miserable without being drunk, and I could act hateful without being drunk. And pretty soon, them things weren't an act anymore. That became me. that he came. And I needed that program to get rid of all that stuff. And I learned that the program didn't give me a, it didn't save my life, it gave me a new life. The life I had wasn't worth saving. And that's, these are things by looking back and forth that I found out by coming to these rooms. But I started drinking just to belong, and all of a sudden we were coming on about this time of year. And one of the guys said, he says he knew an older guy, and if we all chipped in, he'd get us some alcohol in a different package called liquor. And he came up with, we all sat in the Lincoln Park over there on Christmas or New Year's Eve with a pint of blended liquor and a cigarette for a wash. And I welcomed a friend in my life, man. I took a good slug of that thing, and I'm not going to tell you it didn't burn going down, but I drank straight booze until the day I came in AA from that day. You know, if you drank straight, you'll understand. It was a nice burn, so, you know, not too bad. You know, and I shot the second one down. That went down a little smoother, and warmed up the stomach a little bit more, and by then a little bit of it started creeping up, and I'm thinking, this stuff is it's not too bad. It's pretty good. By the time I shot the third one down, that went down smooth, which meant instant manhood. And then all of a sudden, the rest of it started hitting my head, and that stuff went from not too bad to magnificent. And you know, and it gave me some of the promises that that we get in the ninth step that David read here. And the only difference is that the alcohol gives it to you as a hook, and then once it gets you, you can take it back, AA, you can have it, and you can keep it if you want for it. And I found that, you know, all of a sudden I had that new attitude and outlook on life. I don't know if the world liked it, but I thought it was pretty good. And, you know, and I had like a peace of mind. I don't think I had serenity. I probably was a little drunk, but I didn't know that. But I had a peace of mind, and I didn't have, all of a sudden, I didn't have any economic fears. I didn't have fears of other people, and that wasn't a good idea. I drank a lot on 25th Street, and you should have feared some people. But, you know, a lot of times I look back on that, and, you know, it's 50, 60 years ago when you drank on 25th, you got in a fight. I mean, you walk outside, you fight. One person walked back in, the other one might crawl back in. Everybody bought each other a round of drinks and you kept drinking. You know, you didn't shoot each other and stuff like that. So it was a little bit different then, you know, a little calmer, I guess. But, you know, I found out like intuitively I could do anything while I was drinking. And if I didn't have all the rules, I could ask the guy next to me that was drinking and he'd fill them in, because we all knew everything, you know. And alcohol started doing things for me I couldn't do for myself. I don't believe I was instant alcoholic. I didn't have that physical craving for it, or compulsion. I didn't have that mental compulsion to drink. I didn't have none of that yet. And I could take a drink, I could leave a drink. Most of my time became a performance, because they'd say, I don't watch other people, I could drink and I'd perform. And people would say, well, guys, you know, you're 16, 17, 18, you shouldn't be drinking that much. And I, you know, my comment always was, I'm a Polack, I'm supposed to drink that much. And I believed it. I believed that all Polacks, you know, drank as much as I thought I drank. And I don't think they're all alcoholics, but we did our share. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Pat's a good friend of mine. I always say, if you took the Irish and the Bullocks out of AA, you'd have small groups again. I was one of these guys that I was proud of how much I could drink. I don't think I ever lied to anybody the amount that I drank, because I wore it like a badge. I got through high school, just skated through the center, got out, and went to work for a company. I put in a little over 40 years with that company. I retired from it 15 years ago, and that would have never happened if I wouldn't have found the doors of AA. And like most people, I didn't come in AA because I woke up some morning and thought I was an alcoholic. I had my higher power then used to wear a black robe and have a little mallet and that, you know. And I ended up getting in a lot of trouble with the law. And I walked in here on the 13th edition. That was a desire to stay out of jail. I had no desire to quit drinking. That's for darn sure. That just became a requirement at that time. That's all, not a desire. But I went out on my drinking, and you know, I don't know when I truly maybe crossed that line, and it's unimportant. But after looking back on my life and that, I would tell you it was somewhere as I was skating into the Army or skating out of the Army. But I worked about 18 months at this company, and in that 18 months, I should have probably lost my job permanently, there's no doubt about it. I think I had something like nosiness and lazyism, and I don't know, alcoholism maybe was creeping in there, but I was a bar drinker. I loved bars. I mean, it was like, I don't care what bar I went in. When I walked in, if it was carpeted, I said, just the one I was looking for. If it had a dirty floor, it was just the one I was looking for. And if it was bright, it was just the one. Every now and then, I walked into one that lost their license, and that wasn't the one I was looking for. I should have understood that maybe alcohol played a part in my life, you know. But so I really liked bars. And when I started working for this company, I was in like a type of an apprenticeship program, journeyman machinist. And you did a lot of, little stuff on days of study. And back then, you had to learn how to grind tool bits and stuff like that. But they said, you got to go in second shift at 3 to 11 to run the machinery. And I didn't think I was going to like it. When I first went on it, I knew I didn't like it. And I don't know about you people, but if there's anybody in here who was a good, solid barroom drinker, it was almost like AA. You had like two or three bars that you went to, but you always had a home bar. And you had that bar that when you walked in, there was no such a thing as reserve, but you still had that same, your seat. And when you sat, was going to sit there, your drink would be there. And if you were smart and you watched what you call the good drinkers that you thought, the good AAs, you'd realize that, you put your cigarette pack here and your car keys here and your change here, and you got to set this all up, And you had to do this whole little act in this bar. And then you went to that bar every day. And if you went to that bar for 1,000 straight days, if you missed the 1,000th first day and come back the next day, the minute you walk through that door, everybody at that bar would turn around and say, "You should see what you missed yesterday." They'd be like, "Yeah, So now I'm going on second shift. I'm going to miss a lot. There's something wrong here." And I never realized how important that bar was to me until I looked back on that. And that was one of the things that when a guy told me that I could punch out for lunch and go up on 25th, I did that, and I found out that that wasn't a good idea. But I'd turn around and I'd go back and I'd get a pass and he'd say, "I understand, kid," and I'd leave for the rest of the day. But I pushed it, and after 18 months, I went to work for 2 weeks of days, and I walked in on a Monday for second shift. I went to lunch and come back in 2 weeks on days. And they said that, 3 days no work, 3 days no call, automatic quit. And I said, fine. I was going to walk, and the union ran up and said, "We're going to save your job." And I said, "Good, go." And I went on 25th, and I ran into my buddies, and we start talking, and I said, it's mid-50s, we're all single, we're going to get drafted anyway, why don't we volunteer a draft? And they looked at me like I had two heads, and six, seven, eight doubleheaders later, we walked out of the bar right into the building next door, and that's where the draft board was. And we volunteered draft. And I was looking at that. There was a bar across the street and one on each side of this building. I said, "I bet you they never had to send a letter out." People constantly going in there volunteering draft. I went back to work and I gave them my letter and they said, "Well, that'll make a man out of you." And they just rescinded everything and I had my job and I went off to the service. I was born and raised Catholic, but somewhere along the way I was not what you would call a practicing Catholic. I did not disbelieve in a God. I believed that there was one. I didn't use him. I didn't blame him for anything. Didn't give him credit for anything. It was just, I went along with life. They said keep it simple. I kept it simple. If things didn't go right, it was your fault. And if it went right, it was my, I was handling it. And I used to always say I was lucky. And a lot of people used to say I was lucky. And when we all volunteered draft and went into the service, we took 8 weeks of basic. And we took 8 weeks of advanced infantry, and the rest of them went off to the infantry and played soldiers for the next 2 years. And I went down to South America and was trained as a topographic surveyor working for Army Map Service, TDY, the American Geodetic Surveys, and I traveled around South America making topographic maps for Army Map Service. I didn't get in trouble in the military because I didn't have military duty. And in military duty, you can't get in trouble. And I got a straw hat and cut the sleeves off my fatigues, cut them into a pair of shorts and walked around in clogs or something and put jungle boots on when we surveyed in the jungle and just walked around and did my thing. My claim to fame, I guess, down early, but I became a very heavy scotch drinker. And I used to say I drank scotch, but I'm just a classy top shelf drinker. And in fact, it was the cheapest, second cheapest drink in South America. I didn't come in AA puking drunk. And I always said, well, it's one of two reasons. Either I was, I got here before I started puking, or I'm just too cheap to puke out what I put in, one or the other. Probably the latter. But anyway, scotch, I drank scotch because scotch I could drink straight. I drank straight liquor, and I always said that that's why I didn't get sick. I drank straight liquor. It's that stupid cold and ginger ale, soda and all that junk. That's what gets you sick. And the cheapest drink in South America was rum and coke, and that was a sweet mixed drink. And I always say, if you threw up and drank sweet mixed drinks, you deserved every puke you had. And that stuff wasn't made to mix. Why would you mix it? Why would you take good alcohol and throw it in good orange juice or something and say, I got a screwdriver? You want to go get hammered and drink hammers, I started drinking Boilermakers, I didn't want to get hammered. So I drank scotch. Now, scotch was $4.10 a gallon when I was down in South America, and that was for Chavez. Don't get a plane, that was in the 50s. But, that was pretty cheap as far as I was concerned. So that's what I drank. When I got out of the service, I walked into a bar in the States here down on the south side and get my double header of scotch. And hell, I think it cost more than I made an hour. There was a sign that said, drink Calvert's, and I Calvert's my way to AA. I became a shot in the beer guy. I never liked beer all of a sudden. You got to try it. The old timers down on the south side, they said, start drinking these Heaney Hockers, and if you're not old enough, know what a Heaney Hocker is. That's a double header. They take the shell glass and fill it about half full with beer, and they give you the beer free, which they don't do now. And you shoot a little shooter down and sip a beer, And that's the way you drank. And from there, I developed into drinking the Boilermakers, like with Polex, I suppose. But real quickly, from there on, I started dating this gal that I had known for a number of years, but we ended up getting married in 1960, but we celebrated 48 years in August. We're still married, and that's mainly because she stayed in that first 11 years of the break. When we went up to that altar and was supposed to take them vows, she took the vows and I said the vows. And that's something like the program. You can read the steps or you can take the steps. Depends on what you want to do. She took them, and I said, that was it. And life went on. It was like things were the way, there was no change. I just had what I was supposed to have, a wife. And I love my wife as best as I could love a wife or a person at that time in my life. It was a lot different than today. And we got married in 1960, and we had two children. My two sons were, one was 4 and one was 6 when I went to Rosary Hall in March of 72. And during that period of our marriage, I ended up, most people, they hide bottles or something, so they got a stash someplace. Well, first of all, I never drank at home, even though I had a bar in the basement, because I like bars. I liked them so much, I bought one. What the heck? If you want a stash, you might as well just have a key, then you got a 24/7 stash. Walk in anytime you want. And I had that place for about 7 years with my father-in-law. And what that place did for me is it just got me in more trouble because it got me out of trouble, if that makes sense. But during that six-year period, I was charged 7 times with DWI. I was charged once with aggravated vehicular homicide. Had a couple other charges. And I basically danced through most of them. Just like if it was non-existent. I became a person that would, when a cop car would pull me over, it would be in my mind, I'm thinking, boy, is he wasting his time? Because I thought I was untouchable. I just thought that I was completely untouchable. By having that bar, I ended up campaigning for people that won judgeships, and I ended up with a lawyer, and his wife was a judge, and his wife's brother was a federal judge. And you just, back then, you just got out of things you never should have. When I was charged with that aggravated vehicular homicide, a year later, I was found guilty of something, I don't even know the terminology of it. It was, vehicular, I'm a sideby vehicle in the second degree. And I got a slap on the hand and a fine, and I didn't even lose my license, and they turned me back out on the street. And you know, I look back at that, that was criminal. I mean, they didn't even address my drinking. That was like in 69, I didn't come in here until 72. They let me out on that road that long. And I look back on that and I think, I mean, you know, I used to say that God watched over me. God didn't watch over me. God watched over everybody else and kept me out of their way, that's what it was. You know, because they were the people that deserved to be watched over. And so I don't talk a lot about that because that's nothing to brag about. Them were the things, though, that brought me to AA. You know, I was not a person that was this lovable person. I was not a people pleaser. Nobody was very pleased with me when I walked into Rosary Hall. I treated people some like a hand towel in the men's room. You know, when you're all done, you just wipe your hands on it and you throw in a waste can. You know, and because there's somebody else going to come along, so why worry about it? If I drank with you in the bar and we walked across the street and we fell in a manhole, you better have a ladder there because I wasn't going to waste my time getting out. Because why bother? I could walk in a bar across the street, sit down, buy somebody a drink, and pick up on the same conversation. Guaranteed, if I could remember what the heck I was talking about 36 years ago in a bar, I could walk in a bar tonight, buy somebody a drink, and start talking about it. We talk about it like if it's today's news. We had no idea what was going on yet. We thought we knew everything. My world was this big. About the size of a bar stool. That's all my world was. That's all I knew, was sitting on that bar stool, you know, and just went along with anything that went along inside that bar. And that's the way I just went along. I treated my parents bad, my wife, my children. And it was all a matter of just not being there, not being willing to give them a minute, not even a minute. And that's how I lived my life. That was not good. There were the reasons I should have come in, no matter the reasons that I stayed today. I mean, because I understand me today, and I like a little bit better what I am today than I was. But I was going into 1972, and by then, you know, I'd been in and out of courts and everything else, and the system was pretty sick of me, even though, you know, I had not did anything major yet. I mean, they hadn't done anything major with me, is what I should say. In 1972, I was about 8 days into 72, and I got hit on the corner of Virginia and Ridgewood at DWI. I got pulled over for weaving. Always got pulled over for weaving. Always told them I don't weave, I'm a good driver, but they always pulled me over for weaving. I haven't got a ticket for weaving in 36 years, so maybe I was weaving. But I got this ticket for weaving. I got a DWI. I got my George Spanigal, and he literally threw a ticket out because he went to the law school with my lawyer and his wife. But he really chewed me out and said, if you see me again, I'm in trouble. And yeah, it was maybe 8 weeks later, corner of Virginia and Ridge, same cop, another weaving, another DWI, back in front of Spanicle. This time he reduced it to reckless driving, said I needed to learn a lesson. He said, did reckless driving, took my license for 6 months, put me on 2 years of 40 probation, fined me $500, and I walked out and I drove to Barron's Bar in Parma. I bought people rum and drinks and told them I got out of it. Because I wasn't found guilty of DWI. I shouldn't even have been driving. 8 days later on the corner of Virginia and Ridge, got pulled over for weaving, another DWI. This time I got a ticket for driving with a suspended driver's license. I got this other oddball ticket. And I'm looking at it, and the cop's looking at me and said, what's with this? And I said, well, this ticket. I said, what'd you give me this for? And he said, well, you told me you had no car insurance. I said, you've been pulling me over for 3 months. I've never had car insurance. You never gave me a ticket before. He said, what do you mean you never had? I said, why would I want to buy car insurance? That's a waste of money, you know. And he looked at me and he said, do you own a home? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, he said, if something happens and you don't have, you know, you can't pay for it, you know, they could take your home away from you. And I said, so what? I'm never home anyway. Now, that last statement, I don't remember saying that. The reason I know that I said that is 10 years after I come in AA, I had a cop come in AA. And he reminded me of that. And he told me, he said, you know, he says, I drank for 10 more years because when you said that, I figured I wasn't as bad as you. I just thought, good for you. But we're friends today. He's in AA and he's doing well. He's got his 26 years or so. But, you know, I look back on it, that's the kind of person I was. I had a wife and two children sitting in that house. And I wasn't taking care of the house for them. Because that wasn't what was important to me. Alcohol was what was important to me. And however I got it, I got it. But then when I knew that Spanico was going to throw me in jail this time, he told me he would. I got bailed out, I went home, I started packing a bag, messing around, walking around about 5:30 in the morning, and my wife said, what are you doing? Now I gotta tell you, I believe from the moment I was born, God walked with me and tried to guide me through life. It's just that I didn't pay attention, he didn't get my attention. And at age 35, he started to get my attention. And I also believe God talks to people. I don't think I'd want to get woke up in the middle of the night when I'm sitting on the edge of my bed. I'd be a little nervous. But my wife, you know, she looked at me and she said, look, it's 5:30 in the morning. Probation isn't going to come and send a cop to get you and all this good stuff. Why don't you lay down and get a couple hours sleep? When you get up, maybe you might think differently. Now, I'm not going to tell you my wife didn't make sense. It's the first time I heard my wife say something that made sense. That's all. And I thought, okay, and I laid down on the couch for a couple hours, which my wife then made a phone call, and I'd have to be eternally grateful for how things would have turned out in our life. She called my boss. Now, this guy didn't have to come over to the house either, but he came over to the house. He drove over to the house, and he picked up a pamphlet someplace about DWIs, and they woke me up, and he's explaining to me what could happen if you get arrested for a DWI, and by then I had a master's degree in medicine. But, you know, finally I just looked at him. I said, Jim, if I go to jail, because they had promised me 4 to 6 months of jail spending. I said, if I go to jail for 4 months, do I have a job? And he said, hey, he said, you know, you're on salary. He says, we don't give jail leaves to people over here on salary. He said, you don't have that much vacation. You'll lose your job. And I said, well, waste of time. Now, Jim was the plant manager. He could have said, yeah, go ahead, get your things settled, and come back to work when it's done. You know, had he have said that, I might not be standing here today. Because I would, you know, if I had a choice between sitting in a workhouse for 4 months or, you know, giving up drinking, I may have chose going to the workhouse and going back to work. I don't know. But I didn't have too much of a choice this way. And I told myself, we're wasting our time, then I'm just going to cut out of here. And Jim said the right thing, but not maybe for the right reasons, but who cares? It's the bottom line that counts. But he said, look, you got a job today, you got insurance, you're on salary. Why don't you go in this place called Rosary Hall? He said, you can take the cure for your drinking. When you get out, you can do whatever you want to do, but at least you won't drink and your money will last longer. And while you're in there, you'll get paid because of the insurance. And the only thing that clicked in my head is there was a person at the time who was working for me in a machine shop, and he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he used to tell me about this Rosary Hall, and they have this nun there and all of that. And if you go in there, the cops don't bother you, unless you want it for murder. And the only thing when he said Rosary Hall, I said, that's a hideout. I can go in there for a while, plan out my next move. And I said, okay. So they called this guy up in Virgil and out to Rosary Hall. I went. When I went in there back then, you wore pajamas and you wore a robe and you didn't watch television and you didn't read a newspaper and you didn't get no letters and you didn't send no letters and you didn't get no phone calls and you didn't make no phone calls. That was just fine with me. I didn't want nothing to do with the outside world, no how. I had 10 days I stayed in there, and in them 10 days, I can tell you, I ate good, and that was good, and I didn't drink, and that was good, and I had quit smoking 6 months before that on a bet, and I ended up not smoking in Roseville. Also, when I left, I knew I'd never smoke. I didn't have no things about not drinking, and I didn't leave there thinking I was an alcoholic, unfortunately. I would stand there and look at them 12 things, them steps, and one time, Father John the Baptist McCarthy was standing there, we're looking at him, and he said, well, what do you think, Ken? And I said, "It's powerless over alcohol." And he said, "No." He said, "You know," he said, "if you can admit you're powerless over alcohol and your lifestyle manageable," he said, "you admit you suffer from the disease of alcoholism." And he said, "The moniker we hang on you is alcoholic." And I said, "Well, then I'm not one." He said, "You're not." I said, "No." I said, "I'm not powerless over alcohol." And I just didn't believe I was powerless over alcohol. I just couldn't get that through my thick head. And he's talking about, "We had 70 WIs." I said, "So what? I drove 4,000 times like that. What's the big deal?" And you know, I've learned that DWIs don't make you an alcoholic. Alcohol does. But if you're getting a lot of DWIs, you probably got an alcohol problem. You're drinking a lot of alcohol. But I wasn't looking at the alcohol. And you know, sometimes I think, look at that, I think that that's the thing that maybe ruins a lot of people in these rooms, and I was very fortunate. Because I didn't take that drink until I realized I belonged. And but you know, all you got, if you come in here and you only look at the results of your alcoholism, and the results are a DWI, don't drink for a year, you don't have a DWI for a year. You know, if your results are you're not paying your bills, don't drink for a year, you start paying your bills. If your results are the boss that works ready to fire you, don't drink for a year. The boss starts thinking you're a great person. If you're fortunate enough that your spouse stays with you for that year, you might even start smiling at each other. You know, and all of a sudden you think, my life's not unmanageable. Because you've never looked at the unmanageability with alcohol. And the unmanageability with alcohol with me was I was an irritable, restless, discontented person that alcohol could suck back in any time it felt like it. And if I remain an irritable, restless, discontented person, I would drink again. And if I become an irritable, restless, discontented person, I will drink again. And that's what them steps were there for. And I didn't realize that at the time when I looked at it. And so I come in and start going to AA meetings. Now, how did I go to AA meetings? Herman Wall was a director here. He came in on a Saturday morning, the day I was leaving, called me in his office, said, "I understand you don't think you're an alcoholic." I said, "No." He handed me a meeting of alcohol list to pick a full open paper. And he said, "Well, I want you to go to some AA meetings." I said, "I don't need them." He said, "If you go to them, you might not go to jail." I said, "Maybe I'll go to some AA meetings." Yeah. What the heck? And I walked out of there. When I got home, there was a letter on the table saying, "You know, you take a drink, you're going to jail before this is settled." It was from Parma Courts. I had two little beaters in the garage, and they had the state come and take the plates away. And they just said, "Don't get behind the wheel of a car." I got a bus pass, and I looked at this list, and I circled meetings that I could get to on the bus route. The 79 bus route, far east, as far south as it went, far north as it went. Be willing to walk maybe up to a mile. I used to walk a lot anyway. And I could get to about 49, 50 of them meetings. And then I started going to meetings. And you know, I started going to meetings for various reasons. None of them were to stop drinking. But I would go to meetings because, first of all, I played big shot in bars. I owned a bar, so I played big shot in the bar and all that. You know, it was more important for me to buy you a drink and get instant recognition than pay a bill or something. You know, I mean, that was secondary. They got paid, but they were secondary. And so I you know, if you play big shot in a bar, you sure as heck aren't going to take a bus to the bar. That's degrading. Right out loud, you know. Take a bus to an AA meeting. Boy, they pat you on the back and say, "You must really want this. Just keep up the good work." You know? And then I'd go home, and my wife would commence to tell me I'm still a jerk, and I'd say, "Wait a minute. You talk about these good people at AA meetings, and they're telling me what a wonderful job I'm doing, and there must be something wrong with you. You're probably sicker than me. Maybe you better look at yourself." And we drive people crazy even after we get sober. I mean, we don't have to quit drinking. I mean, alcohol has affected all of us and everybody around us, unfortunately. And so I would come home from work on a bus, and I'd sit by the kitchen table, and I'd watch my wife cooking, and she'd be looking at me, and I'd say, "What are you looking at?" She'd say, "That's what I'm trying to figure out." I'd tell her, "Go pound salt," and I'd go to the AA meeting. The guys at the AA meetings, they start telling me, "You got two sons at home. Maybe you got to start playing with them." I said, "Oh, okay." So one day I come home and I set them on the living room floor and I sat down in front of them and we stared at each other. And I thought it was about an hour, might have been 5 minutes. And we're staring. And finally they figured this jerk don't know how to play. So they started playing, and you know, two kids playing is normal. Sounded like 50 kids screaming at me. That's how shot my nerves were. I didn't know what alcohol had done to my nerves. So I went to an AA meeting. They weren't the wrong reasons to go to an AA meeting. They were the ones that got me here. I mean, if they weren't there, I might have not attended an AA meeting. If I had to wait till I had a desire to stop drinking before I attended an AA meeting, I'd probably die drunk. I got the desire to stop drinking attending AA meetings. I learned I was an alcoholic attending AA meetings. I learned there was a solution attending AA meetings. And I learned what kind of a person I truly was attending AA meetings. And then I was told the kind of person I could be if I attended the meetings and put the program in my life. And I ended up with sponsors because they walked into my life. I didn't walk into their life. This is 18 months now. I'm going to meetings, and I'm not thinking I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know what I'm doing here, but I'm here, and eventually I'm going to get out of all this trouble, and I'm going to be off of probation, and by then I'll have it all figured out how I can start drinking, and everything's going to be okay. And you know, I'm that close. And all of a sudden, you know, I lead a meeting, you know, I was leading meetings even before I thought I was an alcoholic, because I thought you needed a good lead, that's all. You know, I would tell you what to do. And, you know, I didn't believe I had to do it, but I'd tell you what to do. And that wasn't too good, because I just got caught in trouble again, leading that whole good, rotten life. I was going to drink, and I had gotten my driver's license back, and had no computers then. That's why I got it back. Some other people now got plenty of computers. But I ended up at Rosary Hall on a Saturday morning, and my friend Lou Williams was sitting there like he always was. And we talked. And I just sort of spilled some of my beans to him. And all he said is, look, he said, just don't drink today. Don't drink today. He said, if it doesn't work out, drink tomorrow. We don't have tomorrow. We only have today. So you'll never take a drink if you don't drink today. And I walked out of there not drinking. I had a lead coming up, and I wasn't going to do it. Somebody said, you got to. So I got up there, and I sort of somewhat confessed that I was, you know, I wasn't leading the life I was preaching, and I was a phony and all that. And people got up and made the famous comment that you still hear a lot today. I heard a man get up and lead a meeting and say that I haven't been in a meeting in 6 months, and my boss is ready to fire me. My wife's ready to divorce me. My kids hate me. And they'd sit down, and people would stand up and say, just keep doing what you're doing, and you'll be okay. Why don't you just buy them a drink? I mean, you know. And when I got done with mine, I had people say, you're up there today, you didn't take the drink, keep doing what you're doing, you'll be okay. And Ted Rusnick was in the back of the room, and he stood up, and he had about 32 years then. That was in 73. And he stood up, and he said, keep doing what you're doing, you'll be drunk in 2 weeks, and he sat down. And he became my sponsor. He walked up to me, he gave me his card, and had Ted Rusnick, his phone number, call me before he'd take the first drink. And he used to have a slot in the card, and there was a dime in it. He gave you that. And he took me over to the East Side, and to the club over there, Broadway Harbor Club, and he introduced me to Gus Pataki, who I really knew. I knew Gus from the South Side, because that's where his tiger shop used to be. And I knew Gus when he was drinking. And he said, Gus is going to be your other sponsor. And they didn't say co-sponsor. He said, you'd be your other sponsor. He said, the book says that if you had a God, if you had a church, give it a try again, it might fit in for you. He says, Gus is Catholic, he's practicing. Run with him. Maybe you can build up on your spirituality again, find that God that's just been laying around for you. And he took me over to the Angel Group, and he introduced me to Neil Craven. He said, Neil Craven's got two sons that's about 6, 7 years older than yours. He says, you watch him. He said, you might learn what a father is. He says, he's doing things with his sons, and he's involved in Little League, and he's involved in wrestling and stuff like that. And he said, the three of us, and he said, I'll take care of the rest. And then this is when he said, well, we can look at getting into the program with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, now I'm in your power, so alcoholic life's unmanageable. And I says, I'm not. He said, what do you mean you're not? He said, I'm not powerless. He allowed me to talk myself into being powerless. See, because I stopped at a bar every day. I mean, there was no reason that I had not to stop at a bar, because there wasn't one good enough. And I would always call home at 3 o'clock and say, I'm leaving work, I'll be home at 3:30, put supper on. And when I said that, it even sounded strange to me, because if my wife put supper on at 3:30, she was crazier than me. Because I'd never home at 3:30. And, you know, I'd be driving home, and I'd be going by Barron's, and I lived a mile and a half from Barron's, but I'd be going by Barron's, it'd be maybe 20 after 3, 25 after 3, and I'd pull in for a drink, and Ted said, see that, it's that mental compulsion to drink. And I said, no, it's not. I said, you know, when you drink in bars, there are rules. I didn't used to drink in bars, you know that, there's rules. I mean, the first rule is, if you tell a spouse you're going to be home at 3:30, you don't come home at 25 after 3. Geez, you give them 5 minutes today, don't want 10 tomorrow. You come home a little bit late and appreciate it more. Just a little bit, see? So you stop for a drink. Well, yeah, you know what happens when you stop for a drink, but I didn't know then. And I would have my drink, and I would walk to the door slowly. I mean, Barron's had 105 bar stools. I mean, somebody's got to come in, did you know? I mean, my good friend Pat might come in the door. Wow, what the heck? And I haven't seen Pat since last night. Maybe I better buy him a drink. You know, until you buy Pat a drink. And so I have a drink. Well, you know, if you're a good alcoholic, that's when economic alcoholism kicks in. Any bar drinker knows this. You buy somebody a drink, you don't leave till somebody buys you kind of one back if it takes 2 months. Because you don't want it stamped on your head, sucker. I mean, you know, you got it. So you stay there till somebody buys you a drink back. And by then it might be 5 o'clock. Well, good grief, 5 o'clock. I mean, you know, you go to any bar. Go tonight. You'll see people drinking at the bar at 5 o'clock. Tomorrow drinking at the bar at 5 o'clock. Wednesday drinking at the bar at 5. Ask them why they're drinking. They'll tell you it's 5 o'clock. They're not going to tell you they're an alcoholic. I mean, alcoholics are safe drivers. We never drove in traffic. That's why we got home 4 in the morning. There was no traffic. You know, I mean, that's not a good knee. You know, and then it's like 6 o'clock. Well, geez, the wife might be a little mad. I told her I was going to be home at 3:30. You know, I told her that for 10 years. I mean, she might be a little mad. You know, well, you know, today the program teaches us if you do, you know, promptly admit when you're wrong. I think the bars taught us to give them another hour to cool off, you know, so you'd stay till 7 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, I'd be arguing with her. Of course, she didn't know I was arguing with her, but I was arguing with her. You know, who do you think you are making me come home? I was the one that said I was going to go home. She didn't tell me. And so I'd teach her, I'd drink till 8 o'clock, and by then I forgot I had a wife. And these guys just looked at me and they said, you know, one little drink, and you couldn't keep a promise to yourself. You can't keep a promise to yourself. You can't keep a promise to yourself when you take one drink of alcohol. Who's the boss? They had me on that one. They had me on that one. And at that point, I was able to admit I was powerless over alcohol. And I understood the irritable restlessness and discontentment that I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. And all they told me is, you know, do you want to become, you know, I was a married parent when I walked in AA. They said, do you want to become a husband? Do you want to become a father? Do you want to become a true son to your parents? Do you want to become a good employer to your employer? If you want to become all of that, then that's what their steps are for. Gus Pataki always told me, he said, you were born a human being before you became an alcoholic. He said, now you're a miserable human being and you're an identified alcoholic. And he said, then 12 steps are to help you not take another drink and to make you a better human being. And he said, that's what the goal is in here. He said, that's what you got to strive for. And he said, the way you do that is you find a God. You find a God of your understanding that you can trust. Not one that you just know exists, but one that you can trust. And when you do that, then you do certain things in your life to clean up the past so that you can live it a day at a time. And he said, while you're doing that, then you start making amends to people. And he said, them steps are written as a way of life. It's the kind of life that people want to live once they start living it and understand it. And he says, all that is to admit you're powerless and your life's unmanageable. And when you do that, then be willing to find a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity. Don't pick an oak tree because an oak tree can't restore you to sanity. Unless you got that oak tree to kid, then we'll take all the mental patients there and we'll just cure the world. Trees don't restore you to sanity. You got to find a higher power that restores you to sanity. You know, and when you do, then be willing to turn your life and your will over to its care, over to that higher power's care. I call it God as well as the steps to. And you know, most of us that come in, we know darn well that we're doomed because of the life that we led. See, you know, we knew right from wrong when we were out there on the street. Because if we didn't know right from wrong, we'd have never lied. We'd have never lied. We'd have always told the truth. Instant lie out of it. Every time I opened my mouth, it was an instant lie. You know, so I, you know, I had to put down them things that what's blocking me from God. And I wrote them down. Fourth step, what do I do with it? I tell it to somebody, tell it to God, tell it to myself. What do I do with that? I look it all over and say, do I want to continue to live that kind of life? If I don't want it, then I take a sixth one and I become willing to have God remove it. Take a seventh one and ask Him to remove it. And just remember, when you're asking for defects to be removed, do the seven-step prayer. Just have Him remove them defects to get you out of the way to become a better person so that you're useful to God and to another human being. Don't get up and say, I think I'll pray for tolerance today. Because you're going to have a bad day. I mean, God's going to give you all kinds of, you know, opportunities to test your tolerance. You know, you might even get a speeding ticket. You might get an accident. Right? You know, don't do that. Let God do the amends, you know. And then go out and make them amends. And you know, when I got to the amends step, I had that accident. It was a number of years from that accident. We talked a lot of talking about that. They tell you to really talk it over with people before you decide to make some amends. Because I really didn't have a problem running up on somebody's porch and knocking on their door and saying, you know, that accident that I was involved in so many years ago that your daughter was killed in, I played a part in that accident. And I'm really sorry. There's something I could do or something. And they looked at me and said, you can't do that. They said, there's no way that you can do that. That them people have been sitting there recovering for maybe 10 years. You don't have a right to open the wound. If God wants you to make that direct amends, it'll be made. Friend of mine in Warren County took him 36 years, but it was made for him because he waited, and I can wait, you know. But you're not off the hook, you know. I learned that when I got into that 10th, 11th, and 12th step, that 11th step will tell me every time what I'm supposed to do, and I was told that by Gus. He told me, he said, you know, he says, if you really practice the 11th step, he says, God will always tell you what to do. And I said, I don't believe that. I said, but He's not going to talk to me. He said, how many times through your life have you sat there and heard something good on the TV or the radio, heard something good that somebody said, a thought come in your mind that maybe was decent, and you followed it up by saying, I'll never do that. He said, well, every time you're sitting there and meditating and a thought comes in your mind that I'll never do that, go back to the previous thought because that's what God wants you to do. And it works. It truly works. There's one little catch to this, though. If you're going to sit and meditate, you know, read a 24-hour book, read a reflection book, read the big book. You know, if you're into religion, go ahead and read your Bible or whatever you read. You know, something decent before you take it over your mind to meditate. Because I'll tell you guys, if you read Playboy, I'll tell you what you're going to meditate on. So, I mean, you've got to know what the heck you're getting your mind set on before you meditate. You know, by doing that, I was able to rebuild a life with my wife, a life that we were supposed to have from the day that we were married, and probably a better life than I would have maybe rebuilt before that. But, you know, I understood then what love truly was because I was capable of now becoming honest. And I was told to just take that honesty and unselfishness in daily practice. And I found out that the honesty is that I got to be honest with me. When I take inventories, I got to look in the mirror, not out the picture window. Because it's easy to take inventories looking out the picture window. And I found out that when they talk about absolutes, I know I can't be absolutely honest for 24 hours. I can't be absolutely anything for 24 hours. But I'll tell you something, I can be absolutely honest for a moment at a time. And if I improve a moment at a time, I'll improve daily. You know, I look at the four absolutes is nothing but the North Star. You know, the sailors used to sail on the North Star. They never got to the North Star, but it always got them where they were going. Use the absolutes the same way. You're never going to be perfect, but it'll get you where you're going. And by doing that, I was able to put that relationship together with my wife and understand what giving love was. Because if you'd asked me what love was when I drank, I would have described getting love, not giving it. I understand purity is, it's simple. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it right? Is it wrong? That's it. Just let it go with that. Keep it simple. Unselfish, just do the opposite that I did when I was drinking. You know, start giving back instead of taking. And because of that, I was able to get involved in a lot of volunteer work, a lot of things outside of AA, NAA, and just in the world in general. Just live that life in general. Be available for my two sons as they grew up. And they're fortunate. They don't have the problems that I had. They don't have any of that. They're both good. I call them good kids. They're both in their 40s. But they are. I mean, they, you know, my wife's been sick a number of years, and they're there for her to help out. They call her, and they're right now they're visiting her daily, and I go there, and it's just things in our lives that we've been able to put together to become a family, You know, and it's to become just a stable, solid family to live together, and that's what it's all about. That's what this is all about. To just become that little bit of a better person that you were before you walked in these doors, and hopefully, you know, be able to help the people that were there helping you a long time ago. And don't worry about so many people that say, well, they can't deal with these earth people. Them earth people ran this world while we were drunk in the bar. So don't pick on them. You know, I think maybe they didn't do too good a job the last few years. But that's the way it is out there today. And it's all because of this program. I'm able to get along with my sons. I'm able to travel with them and have good times. I've made good friendships in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got a life today that never ever would have thought of, never would have wrote. I've learned that Alcoholics Anonymous will never make you wealthy, but it will give you riches that nobody can take away. It'll give you riches that the only thing that can take it away is a drink of alcohol, and the only one that can make you take a drink of alcohol is yourself. And as long as I take care of myself and keep this program in my life daily, I'm not going to take that drink. And if I don't take that drink, I can keep them riches. I can keep them riches, and I can enjoy life for what life's to be. And enjoyment is not necessarily being around things that you like, but you can at least, you can be part of the solution and part of the help for it. And that in itself, you can at least get a decent night's sleep when you do that. And for me, you know, it's been that kind of a life. And like I said in the beginning, I'm not going to wish you a happy new year. Live the life, you'll have a happy new year. Thank you. General prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.